Well, there are not many conferences with such breadth of interest represented and with people from so many different departments as in this meeting, physics, engineering, mathematics. And it's obviously a testimony to the breadth of Jerry's influence and interests. And I wanted to thank you for your encouragement over the years. And I think we met about 20 years ago. It doesn't seem that long, but I would like to talk about a simple system which arises, of course. It's a very basic textbook problem of Hill's equation. And I will remind first of some background, but maybe I'll just say what the everybody saw, of course, this stability diagram for Mathieu. By the way, this is a joint work with Hank Brouwer and Carlos Simo, some of it with Hank, some with Carlos. And so this is a well-familiar diagram. One looks at this Hamiltonian system and asks for which values of A and B is it stable. So some of these stable regions have been shaded. This is an old thing that has been known since the 20s. And what attracted my attention when I was still a graduate student to this problem is that the fact that these stability regions extend to the domain of negative A can be physically interpreted as saying that the inverted pendulum is stable. So you vibrate the point of suspension of the inverted pendulum, miraculously it stabilizes. And so at the same time, I learned about the symplectic group, the simplest one, 2 by 2 area preserving, that means determinant one matrices. And so these problems are, of course, related because such matrices are simply Poincaré maps for such systems. And one time I was walking down the street and stumbled on a crack in the pavement. And in that instant, I somehow realized that the topology of the symplectic group explains why the inverted pendulum can be stable inevitably. It explains the following fact, that if you oscillate, it's a theorem, if you oscillate the point of suspension of the pendulum, and the only requirement is that the downward thrust has to exceed g. You have to accelerate at one instant of time at least, and therefore a neighborhood of at least more than gravitational acceleration. If you do that and pick the length of the pendulum as the parameter, then as the parameter goes down to zero, you inevitably pass through infinitely many intervals where the pendulum has to be stable, linearly stable, and then one can show by KEM then in fact stable for all time near the equilibrium. So this is an old thing, and if I have time, I'll describe it at the end, but that relationship somehow gives a hope that some insight can be gained into stability diagram for this equation or for more general Hill's equations, where this time-dependent function is more general, just an arbitrary periodic function. For example, one thing that I will not talk about probably, but Hang and I did, we observed that for a large class of Hill's equations, so instead of cosine, let's take some periodic function of time with more harmonics. So for a large class of these functions, you see in Hill's equation, what happens is this tangency is, well, it's not even tangent, zeroth order. This is quadratic, this is cubic, and so on. And what if you take a general function? It turns out for a large class of functions, these curves split, they begin to intersect and form resonance pockets, which I'll draw in a second. And it turns out that nth resonance gives rise to n intersections. So at the nth resonance, two stability regions meet at n points, typically. So it gives an interesting interpretation that if you fix B as a parameter and vary A, then on an interval we have infinitely many gaps, these resonance, non-resonance intervals separated by resonance gaps. And as we change B and concentrate our attention on nth instability gap, it will open and close n times. So that's an open question, actually. It's been, Hank and I did it for a class of functions, and we didn't use topology to prove it, but there must be some kind of a topological argument, and I have kind of it constantly slips for me. So this is an open problem, which I think is fascinating to prove this for a more general class of functions using topological methods, which I'll outline. And there has been a lot of work, of course, on Hill's equation, and I'll mention just some of it. Things that are particularly interesting are the work that Joe Keller did, and then it was done by Arnold independently, and they studied how these tongs look near the resonances. In particular, it turns out that if one adds more harmonics to P, that makes the tongs less tangent. And they figured out exactly what happened. So this is the work that I had mentioned. And after this, Hank Brouwer and Carlos Simo, partly numerically, but then partly by symbolic manipulation, showed that this hypothesis that nth gap collapses n times is not always true. So it's not as simple. Okay, so what I would like to describe is this picture that I flashed gives a deceptively simple expectation of what a typical stability domain looks like, bifurcation stability diagram. And that's what was at least the surprise to us when when Carlos ran. He's just a magician with numerics, and not only that, but here's what happens if one looks at, instead of cosine, three harmonics. This is kind of a sketch of stability diagram. And I never realized that there's interesting stuff lurking there. If one simply changes the function like this, then stability regions still look like in Mathieu for small b. This is b and this is a, just like before. But you see what happens, this network. Black things are stable, white are unstable. So you see the stability channel thins out and it zigzags. It's hard to see here, but this stability domain looks like this. And it zigzags to infinity. So why does this? Yes, you just compute Floquet matrix, and he does it like a TV, row by row scans, and every time Floquet matrix acquires an eigenvalue plus or minus one, you mark a point. And so it's very simple-minded in principle, but the devil is in how to actually do it. So, and he did it very quickly. He produces. So this is one picture with three harmonics. This is maybe not as interesting. This is two harmonics. And I didn't shade, but these domains are stable, and here most of the stuff is unstable. So it's very hard to shade it, or maybe. And one more picture. Let's see, how do I do this? Yeah. Yeah, so this maybe shows a little bit better how two neighboring stability domains look like. They kind of bounce off of each other. So the question is, can one explain this? I'm sorry? This represents, what equation? I don't remember what the function exactly was, but it has two extrema. It's like a two-harmonic P. So this P looks something like this. So this is a period. And Another intriguing thing I should mention is, so the first question arises, why does the picture look like this? Can one explain it? And for example, can one explain why do you get this mesh, this kind of lattice? And another remarkable thing that came out of Carlos's calculation, when we looked at this picture, for which I unfortunately I don't have, but it's the picture for the case when we have cosine plus cosine two, first two harmonics. So this is when this periodic function is with two harmonics, then miraculously these nodes turned out to lie horizontally. So why is that? And I'll show that it's a very simple thing, but it's kind of amusing. It turns out that this is explained by the phenomenon that I actually didn't know. And in fact, this leads to the following fact, that if you take a function like this, cosine t plus cosine 2t, well, with the coefficient, so this is the graph of b times that, and if one looks at the potential, think of this now not as a time-dependent thing, but the potential well, and if you look at the energy level and look at the period of oscillation in the two wells, it turns out that these periods are equal for such a function. So it's they know about each other through the fact that they come from this trigonometric polynomial. And this fact, yes, that's right. It's just what I'm saying is, just take a quadratic trig polynomial with cosine t and cosine 2t so that it has two minima, which are distinct. And take the energy level, so look now at the motion of a particle in a potential, in such a potential with a fixed energy E, and here's the period T1, period T2, they're equal for all energy E. Yeah, I mean, the energy has to be, that's right, the energy has to be such that the wells exist, so you have a place to oscillate, but as long as you oscillate, in particular if you draw the tangent to this minimum, then the period here will be computable just, you know, by the second derivative of the curvature of the graph at this point. So it's I mean I could stop now, and but I could just tell the details. So what I would like to do, maybe three things I would like to describe geometrically: what causes these lattices, this lattice structure, what are these curves, and number two, why for this polynomial, why do these curves align, and in particular to prove this observation. And then if there is time, I'll describe I'll give more details on this open question: how can one hope to use topology to understand this kind of pictures in more generality. There should be more. Yeah. Okay.
Dotted lines are continuations of the solid line, right?
Yeah, this has no significance. I think it's just because of the numerical. No, the dotted lines are also stability. Thank you. These dotted lines are also very thin stability channels. They're not broken.
They continue the continuous line.
Exactly. Yes. Thank you. Dottedness is just effect of numerics, maybe. So these are really little channels. So everything looks basically like this. So I don't know. So this is the uh, So everything looks very thin channels, and they meet always in a corner. So what this is it's a pre-image of, I mean, in principle, what we have is a mapping from the parameter AB from given A and B. We know the Poincaré matrix of the Floquet equation, so I'll call it P. And this lives in in SL2R. So it's it's a determinant one matrix. And somehow, this is a three-dimensional set. But because the function is even, it turns out that we really go into just a two-dimensional subset, which is essentially a cylinder. So it's really a question of mapping from the plane to essentially the covering plane of that cylinder. And here, stable matrices sit as a subset. So these colored domains are pre-images of stable matrices. And to understand all this is equivalent to understanding this mapping from plane to plane. So it's to understand better this topology of the map, it has some interesting properties, and I can describe it more if there is time left. But I just want to quickly describe the first question is, why do we have these lattice? Why do we have this lattice structure? So to do that, we have to, maybe I'll then... Oh, thanks. Great, that's perfect. So we can look at the differential equation which I wrote, and let me just write it in the less specific form. So A plus P of T, B times P of T. From now on, it doesn't matter. Until I start talking about this isochronous behavior, it doesn't matter what this P is. P is just a periodic function. And I'd like to draw its graph. That's the only thing I care about. It's positive. I want to write it in the right order. Yeah. Let's say it's positive, negative, positive, negative. So this is one period. So that, for some reason, I would like to choose, I mean, in general, we have n oscillations, but I just want to choose the non-trivial case when, yeah, okay. So what happens? I want to look at, there are rigorous details, which, of course, I don't have time to discuss. But if we look in the phase plane, what happens to the phase plane? When I also should have said that I'm looking for large coefficients. Otherwise, it's impossible to do anything. So for a large... if I draw the graph of this guy, A and B large, it's really very dilated, which is not seen here. So what happens? This is positive, so it's a restoring force. So the particle oscillates very fast, and in the phase plane, we rotate very fast along very eccentric ellipses because this is a large thing. But and that's kind of not such a simple, it's an exercise which takes time, but intuitively, it's perfectly expected that during this time, what we have is an elliptic rotation. So if I look at the Poincaré map from this moment, things just rotate, so the Poincaré map is probably an elliptic rotation, which I call R1. So I want to write the Poincaré map during the period. So what happens? First, my initial point rotates. Then here it's a negative. So the flow is extremely fast this way. It's a hyperbolic time dependent. That's the killer. But that one is much easier to prove that this is a hyperbolic rotation. And then again, we have an elliptic rotation, and then again hyperbolic rotation. So the Poincaré map, this is a little lemma, can be written as a composition of these of elliptic rotation, hyperbolic, elliptic, hyperbolic. And this is a very violent hyperbolic rotation. It extends things by essentially e to the a. That's the order of the eigenvalues. It's extremely violent. So what happens to the initial point, to the set of initial points? Let's start with a ball of initial conditions. After R1, you know, this is what I didn't want to do. I actually can, of course, start at any moment. I mean, that will only make my Poincaré map conjugate to the original one. So I would like to actually do this. So what I want to do is first hyperbolic rotation, then elliptic, then I'll rename this hyperbolic and then elliptic. And that's the period. That's also a period. I'm totally free in my choice of the period, so I choose this. So hyperbolic, elliptic, hyperbolic, elliptic, hyperbolic, elliptic, hyperbolic, elliptic. Okay. So first we undergo a hyperbolic rotation that squeezes this thing tremendously and makes it extremely long, of exponentially small thickness. So of course it's much longer, I just draw the direction, so it's exponentially thin, e to the minus a, something like that. Okay, then it undergoes the elliptic rotation. So I draw this preceding thing as a dotted line just for reference. And from this, we go clockwise lots of times and end up, it doesn't matter, in some position like this. So the initial ball becomes a very long, exponentially thin, almost segment. And then we have our H2 hyperbolic rotation. We'll squeeze it and do the same thing again. And finally, it will, and I will draw this in the same plane. Let me transfer this, by the way, I should have done that. And so this guy will rotate and end up in some positions. So this is the, essentially, if I call B the initial ball, or D the initial disk, then this is PD. Poincaré map applied to the initial disk is like this. Now let me draw the stable eigenvector. Of the first matrix H1. And you see, what hope do we have of having a stable map? In other words, this Poincaré map has to be stable. What is it doing? It stretches unmercifully, then it rotates, then it stretches, then it rotates. So it looks like what we started with became incredibly long. The only hope for this map to be stable is for this violently elongated image to land on what will be shrunk on the next time around. So, in other words, the condition for stability is that the angle between these two guys has to be a multiple of pi. So let me call this angle theta. This angle depends on A and B. And it must be equal to a multiple of pi. That's condition, that's stability, and that's heuristic, okay? But well, eigenvectors don't quite make sense. It's the angle between, okay, this is the unstable eigenvector of VU of H1, right? That's this initial disk got squeezed by H1 like this along the unstable eigenvector. And this is the stable and then it got rotated by, again, then it got squeezed by H2, but this is really the unstable eigenvector of H2. That's what it is. So the unstable eigenvector of H2 has to be rotated by R2, by the last thing we use, to hit the unstable eigenvector of H1. Yeah, let me write this in a different way. So this stability condition says that the rotated, with the rotation R2 of this guy, of the unstable eigenvector of H2, has to be essentially aligned or misaligned, but has to be either parallel or anti-parallel with the stable eigenvector of H1. So that's another way of saying this. So right, it's R2. I mean R2, because R2 is what does it last. H1, you see, it's a funny thing. H2, H2 determines this direction. Almost everything will be squeezed along the unstable of H2, and this, what has been stretched in this direction now has to land on this stable direction. I'm sorry, pi over 2 rotate.
If you had x double dot plus omega x with omega very large, then if you look at the top energy surfaces, like dot squared plus.
Right, they're very elongated. They're extreme. Oh, you mean that these ellipses cause a lot of stretching too? Yeah, but that's nothing compared. This is algebraic in A and B. This is peanuts compared to the exponential. You're absolutely right. I mean, there is stretching, but that stretching is like square root of a or a squared, something like that factor. That's completely negligible to what the exponential compression does. Exponential compression would be e to the... So one can change variables to turn these ellipses into circles. And the exponential hyperbolic rotation will still be exponentially strong. Yes. Yes, that's right. Then everything is a lot easier, right? Yeah, it's true. I mean, you have to. Yeah, the difficulty. That's right. The difficulty is in turning point. The difficulty is to deal with this transition from elliptic to hyperbolic. So. Yeah. Mhm. Right. So in principle, I mean, even if you don't want to follow the details, the idea is that stability can only happen if something stretches. That's inevitable. Stuff does stretch tremendously. So the only hope for stability is what stretched has to land on what's going to be compressing on the next step. And so this gives a certain condition on the angle. And this angle is essentially what would help us to land on the compressing direction. It's the last rotator, right? The angle of the last rotation. And so this is the condition on, so theta is the angle by which R2 rotates, roughly speaking, okay? That's right. Well, that's the other thing. You're absolutely right. So I gave a preferential treatment to R2, but I could look at the map, at the conjugate map, you know, R2 inverse R2, and I could then, anyway, I could have started not with this instant, but with this, and then verbatim argument would say that another way we can have stability is for R1 to rotate. So I will not repeat it, but theta 1 is the angle by which R1 rotates. That's roughly right. Has to be pi And that's another stability. So there are two ways we can have stability. And that's the explanation of these two directions in the lattice. If we have two positive intervals, then we can predict that the lattice will have two directions of stability. These are just level curves of these angle functions that we see. So I probably shouldn't. When do I have to finish? In 15? Okay. So I just wanted to show this. So yeah. So these lines are the level curves of theta 1, and where theta 1 equals pi, and these lines are where theta 2 equals pi k. Okay, so that's one observation. One can actually fix, one can, I don't have, probably I shouldn't spend time on this, but there is a simple way to get an asymptotic formula for these curves. Is necessary too, right? Well, it's not sufficient. It's not exactly equal to pi n. It really is. I mean, more precisely, the condition is that the angle that this vector has to rotate into this vector, and it's also exponential.
Yeah, but that's not my point. If that inequality is not satisfied,
then you're not stable. Well, then you're not stable by this mechanism. It's not clear. Yeah, it's not clear. Then it's. Yeah, it does, doesn't it? I mean, it's. but the problem is that this exponential stretching, it's very coordinate dependent, and if you choose the different starting moment, then you only change coordinates, and in those coordinates, it becomes clear stuff. Gets, I mean, it's not clear because it gets squashed so much that stability still happens in that. So maybe since there is not much time left, I will just give an explanation of why these lattice points align. So schematically, we have, these are stability channels, right, from the overhead. And this is where theta, let's say, theta 2, maybe it was theta 1, I don't know, theta 1 of AB. This is the AB plane. And theta 1 equals, let's say, pi n. And this is where it is equal to pi n plus 1. And so this is stability due to 1. Mechanism, and here is, so this is theta 2 equals pi m, and theta 2 equals pi m plus 1. So in other words, this is where, if we are here, that means that the initial condition got stretched, landed luckily on the compressing direction, and then next time around it got compressed, and so we have stability. That's by rotation with respect to R1, and the same mechanism for R2. Now, why are these things on the same level in the case of a trigonometric polynomial like that? Okay. So, stability. Let me what is theta 1, roughly speaking? Theta 1, roughly speaking, is the number of times we rotate in the phase plane, and that can be shown to be equal to the square root of, in the leading order. Okay, where Q is this right-hand side, this is Q. So theta 1 is integral over the part where Q is positive, and there are two such parts, R1 and R2, right? So this is over the interval. Let me label this interval I1 and I2. And if we can assure these intervals depend on our parameter A, right, because Q has A in it. And if we can show that the difference between these two doesn't depend on A, then we're done. So to explain, so theta 1 depends on A and B, but I fix B, so so I want to look at theta 2 minus theta 1, and I want to show that it's independent of A, so let's take a derivative with respect to A. Well, this integral goes from 1, t1 to t2, where these are the roots of the integrand. So if we differentiate, the derivative with respect to endpoints vanishes because the integrand vanishes at the endpoint. So the only contribution will be from derivative of the Q with respect to A. Q is this expression differentiated with respect to A is just 1. So it's integral of 1 over square root of Q from T1 to T2. Well, from T2 to 3, 4, right? Minus integral from T2 to T3. Okay, so if, I mean, this is the wishful thinking. If we can show that the difference doesn't depend on A, then if this belongs to the intersection of the zones, then so does this. So the real question is, why does this not depend on A? In other words, why are these two integrals equal? Why are these two integrals equal? Well, let's look at the t-plane. T is the, but I want to complexify t now. So here's the t1, t2, the interval i1, t3, t4. So our q is positive on this interval and on this interval. So I want to show that these two functions are equal. Again, I repeat that Q is the trigonometric polynomial, essentially involves cosine of T and 2T. So it's a trigonometric polynomial of this kind. So why are they equal? Well, let's extend the square root to the complex plane. So we have to figure out how to do it. Well, let's assign positive value to you see positive value to the upper edge of the slit. So I make a slit in the complex plane and take a little contour around each slit, infinitesimal contour. And what is the, this is now a complex valued function. Let's see how we can extend it. If we, Q is positive, so I decide to assign it a positive value just above the slit, right? Then if I go around, I change the argument by 2 pi. Because of the square root, the change happens by e to the pi, so it becomes negative, right? So I'm forced, once I've decided positivity here, it's my function is real negative right on the bottom of this thing. Of course, it's complex elsewhere, but, and then, okay, but then let me go here and straight. Then my argument changes by pi, so square root makes it complex. Well, I don't have a real value here, it's purely imaginary here. And then it does this again here. There is another root of q here, and so now it becomes negative above, right? It gets multiplied by I each time I pass right above the root, right? It multiplies by I, and again multiplies by I, becomes negative. I zip around, it becomes positive. So this is the Riemann surface of our function. It's just, let's take a strip from 0 to 2 pi or whatever the period is. Let's say 2 pi because the period is 2 pi, right? And now I can take a big contour like this with a high height, large height h, which will go to infinity. And now the standard thing happens. The integral is 0 over the boundary. So this integral, of course, vanishes in the limit because these cancel and this is exponentially decreasing. It's 1 over cosine, but cosine is exponentially large up there. So the boundary integral is 0 plus integral over this plus the integral over that. But because of these signs, you see these integrals are just integral, for example, around this closed contour is just negative twice the integral from T3 to T4 of 1 over square root of q in the conventional sense, right? So the integral is this, and the integral over this is plus twice the conventional integral, T1, T2. So that's 0 by Cauchy's theorem, and so so it's by complex variables. So they kind of communicate with each other through infinity, so to speak, right? Yes, for n, there will be a relationship. Then you don't have them equal, but their combination will be 0. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it doesn't actually matter that we have cosine, we could have sine, as long as it has two minima. So that's kind of, I would have never thought about this question if it, if Carlos's computation didn't show that these lattice points are leveled. And so I have to finish now or in... I have 5 minutes. Maybe I'll just describe this open problem a little bit in a little bit more detail. How? Unless I forgot something. Yeah, there are a lot of details that, unfortunately, are messier once one. On the intuitive level, it's obvious, but how does one prove these things rigorously? It's less pleasant. So maybe I'll describe very quickly the topology. Many people know this, so I apologize, but it's only 5 minutes, and that's my. So, okay. So if we have this Hill's equation, right? Q of Tx. Now I don't care what Q is as long as it's periodic. And we look at the Floquet matrix, which maps xx dot to xx dot after one period. Might as well take it to pi. Let's call this P of, let's call this Z naught, right? Let's call it Z. Okay, PZ. So this is a 2x2 determinant 1 matrix. And the question is what, so determinant P is 1. What's the set of such matrices? It's SL2R, so it's a subset of, it's an example of, it's the two-dimensional, the simplest example of the symplectic group. It turns out that this set is topologically a torus. This is a result by Gelfand and Lidsky. It's a very pretty thing. So the topological structure of this set is an open solid torus, a three-dimensional open solid torus in space. So it's like a donut without a skin. I don't have time to prove it. It's a very simple thing to prove. So that's the question number one. Now, these matrices can be either stable or unstable. In other words, they can be either elliptic rotations, meaning that they preserve ellipses, and therefore, of course, the iterates are bounded of such matrices, or they are hyperbolic rotations, always determinant one, of course, and the intermediate case parabolic rotations when the two directions coalesce and become eigenvector one, and then things look like this. That's the intermediate case. Okay, how do these matrices sit in this torus? Well, it turns out that it's another result of Gelfand and Lidsky, that the stable matrices form a kind of a banana-shaped open sets, two of them. So it's like if you take this torus and pinch it to ends, you get two banana-shaped regions which touch each other, and these points are identity matrix, correspond to identity matrix and to minus identity matrix. And so what we're dealing with when we look at the Mathieu equation, we have these two parameters, A and B. In general, of course, this is a question of mapping a function Q. It's a functional from function Q to the Poincaré matrix P, which is just the point in the torus. So, I mean, to really understand the problem, one has to understand this map, which is probably hopeless. But if one picks a two-parameter family of Qs, like in Mathieu equation, then I think it's on the borderline of doable to really understand the topology of how the surface, you know, so P, in other words, if we have A and B, which Q depends on, then this Poincaré map, which is really just a point in here, P depends on two parameters A and B. So we have some two-dimensional surface embedded in this torus. And to understand the topology of this, so I will not, I can say much more details about it. And in particular, if we fix, look at symmetric functions, even functions, the picture is easier. Then not every any matrix can occur here, but only a kind of a cylinder of matrices can occur. So that makes the problem a lot simpler. Then the question is, how does the AB plane map onto this cylinder? And there are some really interesting features. It's wrapped and folded. It's a transcendental wrapping and folding, and there must be some topological characteristics that I can wave hands, but it's like you wrap the surface on the cylinder and you pull some points up and some points down, so you create a bunch of creases, and I don't know how to formalize this to get a topological picture of these material regions, but it's very addictive, but I don't know how to do it. Okay, so